Hi, welcome to Food with Mark Bittman. As always, you can reach out to us at food@markbittman.com. We're happy to hear from you. We'd love to hear any comments you have about the show, and we'll happily respond. Please also consider subscribing to our near daily newsletter, The Bittman Project. That's at bittmanproject.com. And of course, subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, and leave us rave reviews. Back in a sec.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the multi-terrain select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. I met Kasten Trenner probably 15 years ago when he was at Greenpeace, a warrior trying to prevent fishing piracy at sea. I admired him. We did a story together for The Times, and we've been friends ever since. We started by talking about fish, of course, and the extractive industry that relies mostly on sucking it out of the sea. We've never stopped. At about the same time, Kin Lui, a sushi chef, recognized that the upswing in the global popularity of sushi was directly threatening the existence of many fish, including one of the kings of the ocean, the bluefin tuna. Eventually, the two would join forces to create what became vegan, that is, fishless sushi dishes. And they created restaurants, several to date. None of this is as incongruous as it sounds. Sushi has always been primarily about rice, not fish. The word sushi itself means soured rice, a reference to the vinegar that's used to prepare it. What it does not mean is pieces of fish wrapped with rice. Vegan sushi is not an aberration, but the norm. It's about the rice, not the fish. In this conversation, the three of us, Ken, Kasten, and I, talk about sushi in general, about the threats to our fish supply, about Kasten and Kin's restaurants, about why sushi can be great without fish. There's a lot to unpack here, and it's all pretty interesting. Here we go. Caston, we met probably 15 years ago. You were at Greenpeace still.
I was just starting. I think we met because of the Nobu campaign, and that was my first campaign that I ran there. So this was 2009.
Yeah, and that was when I was writing an aquaculture piece, I'm pretty sure, for the Times Opinion section.
Yep.
So we've stayed friends, and you've gone off into this sort of, you're like a serial non-fish sushi restaurant founder, and now you've done that with Ken, who's with us also. Ken?
Yes.
I don't quite know where to start. I know we want to talk about what sushi actually is and what it means, which I think is going to be an awesome conversation. But maybe a little history before we get into that would be good. That is, how did you get into this, Caston? How'd you hook up with Ken? How'd the two of you start working together?
You're right. It's an interesting discussion. The question is, where do we begin? I guess if any place works, it's maybe the way that Ken and I grew up. Because for me, that's why I work in what I work on. It really is. I grew up on the beach. I developed a real love, not just for the ocean, but for all the funny little mysteries that come out of it. You know, when I was a little kid, I used to go down to the beach and dig for clams and stuff and bring them home to my mom, and she would cook them. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world, you know, for a seven-year-old boy to be able to bring this stuff back home and have it turn into food.
Where was this beach? That is kind of great.
Washington State. And, you may think like, well, the beaches in Washington, not that great. Yeah, okay, nine months out of the year, you're right. But 3 months out of the year, they're spectacular. And those were real special times. Summer, as a little kid on the beach in Washington, those were halcyon days. And anyway, fast forward, go off to college, stuff like that. I start coming back. And in the meantime, my town is exploding population with, you know, all the new people moving in for Microsoft and Boeing and everything. Basically, because of runoff and population explosion, that little beach starts to die. And I watch it in sort of freeze frame, you know, coming back every summer, coming back every winter from college, to the point where I would never eat anything from that beach now. It's polluted. It's just dead. And I think that really, that did something to me. Later in my life, I didn't want to work on anything that didn't have to do with ocean conservation. But I had also really developed this love for seafood and for the like I said, the mystery of all the creatures in the ocean and that connection between people and those animals and those plants. And I think that's sort of what brought Ken and I together. And I'll kick it to him for his background, but we bonded over two things, over this shared love of seafood and of that connection with the ocean, but also of our shared concern that something was wrong and that we needed to fix it in our small way.
Well, I was born in Hong Kong, Asia. And when I was 15 years old, I moved to Hawaii. And I just been working. And something about the ocean that I really like to spend time. I'm not a great swimmer, but sometimes just by the rocks, there's like a calm, like a moment that you can really feel there's life everywhere. And that's the time then when I kind of start learning. I didn't know how to fish. I mean, I went to the house too. But I always loved fishing by the ocean in Hawaii. For myself, just I don't need to catch any fish. Just being around the ocean is really something that I love to do. Around the same time that when I first time tried my sushi experience. First time I ate it, you know, just like, wow, this is, you know, it's, you know, because when I was a kid, I was broken. Never really get a chance to eat sushi. So up until, you know, later age, I was just like, oh, wow, it tastes really good, you know, with seafood and sushi rice. And that's kind of how I got into the working different restaurants since I was 16 years old.
In San Francisco, in Honolulu?
Yeah, in Hawaii. And you know, the time that when I moved to San Francisco, you know, I worked a few more different restaurants, sushi restaurant here and there. That's when I actually learned like the skills, the preparation from learning different masters.
It's interesting. Ken and I, we've always worked together. Everything that I've ever done sushi, you know, we've always worked together. And when we first met, you know, I was already engaged in ocean conservation professionally. I'd been working with Sea Shepherd. I was on the way to taking the sustainable seafood gig with Greenpeace, et cetera, et cetera. But I had this love for seafood and sushi from when I was young. And Kin had been working professionally in sushi, but he had developed this love for ocean conservation. Mm. And we shared values, but we were coming at this Venn diagram overlapping space from two different angles. So we were able to bring two different skill sets to the table. And we opened Tataki Sushi Bar February 26th, 2008. And that was our attempt. Yeah, 2008. That was our attempt to bring sustainability into the sushi zeitgeist. And that's where the ride began.
I mean, you were not exactly kids, but you were really young at that point.
We were. We were in our 20s. Nothing. I didn't have any joints that hurt on a daily basis.
Please.
I still had hair. I mean, there was, yeah, we were young. We were young, spry individuals back. We had to be. Yeah. That restaurant was a crazy risk. We didn't have any money. We opened it on a shoestring. So when we first opened it, Ken and I and our partner Raymond, we were doing everything. We eventually got a couple people for front of the house, but it was like a skeleton crew.
The food at Tataki was what we think of as quote unquote normal sushi, or were there unusual things about it?
Both. Our vision for Tataki was to create a really enjoyable, comprehensive, modern sushi experience, but only relying on sustainable options. And back in 2008, what that meant for us was we were going to take the guidance of the scientists that we respected. And for us, that was the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They were the kings back then. They were the ones developing all of their science. They were the ones that was uncompromised by industry as an independent shop. So, and they were right down the beach from us in Monterey. And we had good relationships with them. So basically that was our business model is, hey, can we open a sushi bar that's only using things that the Monterey Bay Aquarium says, yeah, you're good with this.
Right. The greens, the ones with the green sticker.
Yeah. And it prompted a lot of interesting conversations because, you know, they're just as limited as everyone else. They can't review every fishery in the world. Right. And there's a lot of principles around sustainability that we wanted to explore. You know, things like, what if we use something really local? What if we use a small fish that comes in that lives in the bay? Monterey doesn't have the capacity to create a whole fishery review for this. Does that mean it's unsustainable? So it prompted a lot of interesting conversations. But at the end of the day, Ken and I, our watchword was always, we are not scientists. Part of running a sustainable sushi restaurant was learning how to be humble in the kitchen and allowing the scientists to tell us, yeah, this is okay or this isn't. And we didn't always want to listen, but we needed to. That was the whole point.
Was a qualification that stuff was local or sustainable could mean global and sustainable?
So that's a really interesting question. We had a lot of different battles to fight coming into this space. The conventional sushi industry is problematic, to say it mildly. And we can talk about this more if you'd like. But the reality is we had a lot of different problems to solve. The over-exploitation of fisheries, how fish were caught, how much carbon was used to get them there, et cetera, et cetera. So we actually had to sort of set up a priority ladder. We couldn't hold every problem at the same level of gravity. So we had to make some qualitative, subjective decisions. What we decided to do was we start from the point where we build a menu, and I'm sure Ken remembers this very well. We build a menu where we are only using yellows and greens from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. We start there, the good alternatives and the best choices. And that is our floor. From that point, we never go down or sideways. We always go up. Our bylaw, our agreement, bylaw sounds formal, it's just three dudes in a kitchen, but you know, our agreement was anytime we wanted to put a new fish on, we needed to take something off. And the new fish needed to be better than the old one. it needed to be better in some way. Either it's more local, or it's going from a yellow to a green, or it's caught in a method with less bycatch, et cetera.
Right.
So it was sort of a scattershot approach, but our whole idea was we are not going to get this perfect, not now, not ever. The best that we can do is acknowledge that sustainability is a moving target and just always try to make the best decision that we can, while at the same time holding a very rigorous floor. I think that's really important, because a lot of restaurants could say, yeah, well, we do the best we can, et cetera. That's fine. But unless you have a pretty solid position below which you will not go, it means nothing.
Ken, as the chef in those days, was it challenging to have that kind of limitation? Were you like, I mean, I know you were as committed to this as Cassidy was, but were you like, come on, let's use whatever? And or were you like totally down with it?
Oh, no, not at all. I totally down, you know, I was totally down with it. You know, for my part, it's just the source of getting, you know, which type of fish was just very, very hard.
Yeah, this was a challenge. A lot of times,
cross off my first menu. You know, we created the menu, but then, you know, over the course, Cassidy just keep like, you know, crossing this and that, and we have to really just follow the guideline, how to order, where to get it. That's one challenge. And the second thing is we try to be more creative instead of just not working on it at some point. So different fish, we got to find a way to make it taste good, to make it unique, to make our, you know, to put our menu together. That was the hard part. At the same time, was the most fun part for myself. You know, I like the challenge as well. If every, you know, think about it, if every restaurant is serving the same thing, then, you know, you can basically go anywhere, right? So for me, if okay, we have a challenge right here that we're not doing the same thing, but how do we be more creative to make this menu works? That was a long, long, long progress.
Yeah,
which was fun. I mean, now I look back, was really fun.
What was some of the unusual kinds of fish that you were using that people wouldn't have seen in a more conventional sushi restaurant? We're going back to 15 years now, right?
I guess one of the, it's the sable fish.
Yeah.
Right, Kasim? Yeah, that was one of the things, because everybody loves unagi.
We had specific problems to solve, right? Sushi, like Mark, you and I have had sushi together before. Like, sushi is a story when it's done right. It's a journey that it occupies different textures and different flavors and different experiences from start to finish. And a good chef is going to really take you on a voyage with those things as you go through that sort of rainbow of experiences. Our goal was to be able to provide that, but a lot of the standard vehicles that a lot of conventional sushi bars would use, we didn't allow ourselves, right? You want to create that really supple, fatty experience. Well, a lot of sushi bars use bluefin. We're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. You want to create that dark, sweet, sultry experience. A lot of sushi bars use unagi and kabayaki sauce. We're not going to do that. So because of those limitations, we needed to find a new way to develop that architecture while still being able to tell a comprehensive story of this is the dinner that we're going to share together, right? Mm-hmm. So we had challenges. And Ken's right. One of the big ones was unagi, freshwater eel. Unagi is an ironic reality in the global sushi industry because it's used super commonly in the United States and Europe, et cetera, to deliver this really sweet, flaky experience, usually later in the meal. The irony of it is that it's a very threatened species in a very destructive industry. And at the end of the day, you don't really even taste the fish. It's used as a vehicle for this sweet, syrupy sauce. And when we first started Tataki, we asked ourselves, why are we doing this? Why would we use an endangered species or a species from such a destructive antibiotic laden industry just to deliver this sugar. We can deliver this experience using other methods. But the reality is that freshwater eel, especially cooked the sort of classic way in this industry, has a unique textural experience.
Mm.
So we needed to find a way to deliver something akin to that. And we tried a lot of different things. But as Kim mentioned earlier, we ended up using sablefish. We ended up doing a finding a way to cook sablefish that created this really flaky experience. We were able to use a sweet dark sauce on top of it and deliver something that people found really enjoyable and familiar, but that didn't rely on an unsustainable product. And that recipe really blew up. That recipe was actually one of the things that put tataki on the map and started getting us press.
As the years went by, and I'm not entirely certain of this history in terms of the two of you together, but as the years went by, I know you, Kasten, felt more and more like fish just wasn't going to be a part of the picture, that there was sort of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I have the impression that you started to feel as if there's no such thing as sustainable sushi or no such thing as sustainable fish.
As we spent time in the industry, not only were we learning, but the world was changing. And things, people were trying different things, and some were working and some weren't. And we were watching, you know, hey, we've got more restaurants doing the sustainable thing. Are the stock levels coming back? Well, in a lot of cases, it didn't seem like it.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken and I, you know, we were always a mission-driven partnership. Our focus wasn't to have a restaurant for the sake of having a restaurant. That's crazy. Our focus was to have a restaurant because we wanted to be a part of the kind of world that we believed in. And again, you know, we were united largely by values. And so eventually we had opened a few more branches of tataki. We had brought on a couple more partners. You know, we fast forward to about 2014 now. And we had always had two watchwords, sort of our mantra for a restaurant, which was eat better fish, eat fewer fish. That was it. You know, we should be having sushi less. And when we do it, we should be eating better fish and making a bigger celebration of it. It should be a bigger deal. It's this, I'm having sushi four times a week for this sort of ersatz 9-piece sushi lunch. That's the real problem. That's what's causing all the damage. So we always thought this eat better fish, eat fewer fish was the way to success. But we had to be honest with ourselves that we were only doing half the work. We were doing a pretty good job with eat better fish. We really felt that tataki and the other restaurants that we had opened were offering really solid, sustainable sushi solutions in terms of seafood. We weren't doing that good of a job with eat fewer fish. We had some vegetarian items on our menu. We thought they were pretty good. Nobody ever ordered them. And the reality is it wasn't going to work. So Ken and I, we just got together one day and we said, you know, we had just gotten the opportunity to take over a new space. Yeah, a new space in the North Mission in San Francisco. We were really excited about it. It was slated to be another tataki. And we sat down and said, you know what? What if we don't open another tataki? What if we open a fully vegan sushi bar? What if we just be real honest and lean into this eat fewer fish piece and create options that people of all stripes, omnivores, vegans, vegetarians, everyone can enjoy together with a light footprint? We didn't feel and counter to our mission. We felt that it was the next natural step.
We'll be right back with Ken Liu, Kasten Trenner, and me.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Hi, folks. We have a new sponsor and an interesting one. We all take about 20,000 breaths a day, and Americans spend about 90% of our time indoors. That indoor air that we breathe can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air, according to the EPA. And indoor air pollutants can cause respiratory symptoms like sneezing, congestion, scratchy throat, and even more serious health problems like lung and heart disease. So, what's the solution? Introducing Air Doctor, the air purifier that filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so your lungs don't have to. This includes allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code BITMAN, B-I-T-T-M-A-N, and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to our listeners, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. Lock in this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com. That's AirDoctorPro.com and use the promo code BITMAN. Can we talk a little bit about what sushi means, where sushi comes from? This history is really an interesting key to the future of enjoying sushi in a way.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up. This is another thing that Ken and I always tried to come back to is this idea. We're not inventing anything. We didn't come up with sustainability in sushi. That was always the point. And it's something that's been lost. So sushi, the word in Japanese, sushi means vinegared rice. That is what that word means. There's nothing about fish in the context of that word specifically. But who cares? We have lots of words like that in English too. That you break down, like, yeah, maybe it's not about something, but it's become about that. And I acknowledge that. But I think it's important to recognize the roots of the cuisine, because it's only with that information that we can understand A, how we got to this problematic place, and B, how actually the cuisine itself, we believe, Ken and I at least, can help us solve this problem to keep the art of sushi alive and also make the ocean a healthier place. So sushi arose really as a response to a problem. And the problem was that Japanese communities in certain areas of southern Japan didn't really have access to good storage or refrigeration technology. This was a problem because they had, like many other places in the world, a seasonal variation in the availability of protein. And this is a problem all over the world. And in this specific case of Japan, a lot of it had to do with certain species of fish that would arrive in very large quantities during some portions of the year and then just not be present at other times. So there were ideas of, well, how can we keep this bounty for leaner times of the year? And also, how can we get it to other parts of the country that don't have access to this protein when we don't have refrigeration and we don't have ice and we don't have all those things like that to keep it safe? A lot of these fish, you know, very common fish, things like skipjack tuna and bonito, things that formed the cornerstones of a lot of sushi cuisine and the recipes and the flavor profiles, they didn't freeze well. They didn't transport well. They didn't, it was difficult to get them from place to place. So these problems had to be solved. One of the ways that this problem was solved was some of these fish would be packed in an airtight container. And the best way to create an airtight container was to cook rice, pack the fish in this rice, and then press it in boxes to get all the air out of it.
Whoa.
That would keep the air away from the meat of the fish. Then they could take it from the beach up into the mountains to Kyoto or wherever it was going and serve it, and it would have a longer chance to get there. But that wasn't good enough by itself. The reality is it wasn't a perfect method. So the Japanese merchants needed to develop a way to help the consumer be even more safeguarded against any potential problems. Again, no refrigeration. So if they couldn't prevent all of the bacterial growth on the fish, the next best thing they could do was forewarn and forearm the consumer to be better prepared to eat the fish. So they began to serve and present condiments that would actually make their consumers, the people that were going to eat the fish, more impervious to any potential bacteria that might be there. So they wanted to get their digestion really fired up. And what did they use? They used garlic and they used horseradish. And that's why we now have sushi coming out of this idea, this combination of sushi, vinegared rice, which is how we created this packed space to get the oxygen out. The fish or whatever was being transported, it happened to be fish in this case, but as you said, Mark, it doesn't have to be. And then wasabi and ginger, this idea of let's make sure that this is going to be as safe as possible to eat since we didn't refrigerate it. And fast forward 100 years and we have a global cuisine based on these flavor profiles.
It's a great story. And there's two things about it that are notable from my perspective. One is that when you go to a sushi restaurant where they really know what they're doing, the rice is kind of the best part anyway, and everybody knows that. And then the second thing is 3/4 of culinary history is figuring out how to find some protein to combine with your grains, because grains are the backbone of human diet. All the majority of calories still come from grains, whether they're ultra processed or whole. That's where most calories come from. And then, of course, the most important source of protein is legumes. But still, for a billion people, fish is the most important source of protein. So, and a lot of that remains wild. So let's go back to the conversation the two of you had about, here's a thought. Let's be true to the roots of sushi and go back to the rice and whatever it is that you have to make it taste different.
So I can almost draw this connection, but that we're missing one piece, which is that I've only talked about really one of the sort of traditions of sushi, that we were looking at. And that's this idea of how do we, where it came from. You know, well, it's really just about the rice. It's really about doing the best we can with that. But the other piece is about really honesty. Sushi is about being honest about what's available and then doing your very best to make it the best thing that it can be. A lot of the things that we now see in the sushi industry, these quote unquote sushi fish, they're there because those were what were available in the bay in front of Tokyo back in the day when this was happening. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that's no longer the answer to the question, what do we have access to and what's the best that we can do? So with Ken and I, when we were thinking about this new concept, we asked ourselves, hey, what's really the best that we can do right now? What do we have access to? And the answer were plants. Plants was what we had access to. So again, we didn't invent anything. We're just looking back at the principles of sushi. Do the best you can with what you have access to, where and when you are, and try to make it help and serve as many people as possible.
And actually, it takes more time to work with vegetables at some point, because everything has to be very detailed. For example, marinated tomato, let's just say. The tomato, the ripeness of the tomato has to be kind of perfect. And the way how we prepare, the way how we kind of marinate, timing-wise, has to be kind of exact, like right there. And some of the vegetables we even age for a day that actually tastes better than the first day. Hmm. So it's kind of sort of like when you have tuna, you know, first, you know, a lot of sushi shop know about it. You know, fresh tuna, got a fillet, you know, bring to the restaurant. You don't actually serve the first day. You actually age in the refrigerator for like a few days. Let the meat kind of change the kind of texture that however you want to serve your customers.
Firms up a little bit as it ages it?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like we look back at that part of our education and we apply that as much as we can to plants. And obviously plants are completely different organisms than animals. They're not made of the same building blocks, but at the same time, it's surprising to see the overlaps in terms of how we can approach them to create and coax out those levels of umami and those levels of complexity that we want to get from vegetables and mushrooms and pickles and fruit. It's really interesting. We've learned a lot.
Can you think of some breakthroughs or some interesting examples of stuff that you were doing back when you were figuring this out?
That was a lot.
I remember when we figured out how to make vegan ramen broth that had the level of richness that we were trying to create.
Without putting polar bears in it.
And that was a big day. You can get vegan ramen at a lot of places now, and that's wonderful. But when we were first starting, it was very rare. And the ones that you could get, they weren't an acceptable facsimile of what people really wanted. It was yet another example of, oh, you can either bring your principles to the restaurant or you can get good food, right? And that's just not an acceptable dilemma. That's not a choice that people that are trying to live in a different way, trying to have a lighter footprint or have health restrictions, people for whatever reason that have a vegan diet, they should not have to compromise on the quality of what they eat just to do the right thing. And we have always tried to bear that in mind. It's never been good enough for us unless it was going to be good enough for everybody. The idea of like, oh, we can eat here. It's not great, but it's vegan. That's not the restaurant we set out to build.
Right. I mean, just to be completely clear, it's almost coincidentally vegan sushi, and the target audience is not vegans. Not that there's a reason for vegans not to eat there, but it's coincidentally a vegan restaurant.
It's coincidentally a vegan restaurant. That's exactly right. We did not set out to serve vegan food to vegans. We love serving vegan food to vegans.
Right.
Great. And our vegan communities in the cities that we have restaurants are really the reasons that we've succeeded and we are so grateful. But The reality is we don't change the world by serving vegan food to vegans. We change the world by serving vegan food to omnivores.
Right.
That's what we set out to do.
Yeah. That's a noble goal. So tell me what's happening now. Ken, you're in Honolulu. You're running a restaurant. Cassin, I actually don't know what you're doing.
I don't either.
The idea remains.
The concept remains. The business grows. We are in the process of looking at a few different cities for our next location, which would be our fifth restaurant. And we're always excited about these kinds of things because new locations bring new ideas. They bring new access to different agricultural spaces, new foraged ingredients, new wild ingredients, et cetera, et cetera. Our business model is always to have our menus about maybe 70% the same, you know, drawing on a lot of the traditional Japanese flavors and those kinds of things that we've been able to create in our own way, and then have them about 30% unique. So every restaurant is different. Every restaurant has its own homage to where it is and who is cooking, because that's a big part of sustainability, is to not try to do the same thing everywhere all over the world, because that's not the way the world works.
Right. Ken, talk about your restaurant.
It's called Tane, T-A-N-E, you know, in Japanese. Translated means a seed. You know, after living in the Bay Area for like 13 years, and took us 4 years to decide moving back home to Hawaii.
And how are things going?
The thing's been going great. You know, it's kind of sort of like the same kind of thing that, you know, I expected as well. I opened Tane kind of. It was like the first vegan sushi bar in Oahu, in Hawaii culture. Fish, it's like the biggest thing on the island. For myself to take that risk to open a vegan sushi bar, it's a different level than in Bay Area. But I believe stuff that we all create, I could bring it back home here and share with everyone that walks into that door. It has been a lot of supporters. First was the vegan community, which I can't say enough thank you to them. And second of all was the local, you know, our neighbors. They're not vegan. They're willing to give it a try. And most of them, they really like what we do. And I'm very thankful for that. And they became regulars. And also there's visitors from all over the world that, you know, would come in with suitcase that they just got off the plane and they just want to eat here, or they make a reservation like months or weeks ahead of time when they visit Honolulu. And I'm very, very thankful of, you know, the journey of the restaurant, and I'm very thankful for everyone that has been supporting the restaurants.
That's great. Cassin, I need to hear what you're doing, and I need for you both to talk a little bit about what you think, if there are future plans together or separately.
I'm crazy enough to be involved in restaurants, but I'm not crazy enough to be involved in restaurants alone. We started this journey together. I don't have any desire to go off anywhere else. Ken is the reason that all of this works. I'm just the guy that talks a lot and comes up with ideas, most of which are crazy. So from my perspective, if and as we continue, it will be as a team. And I think we have a lot of interesting stuff coming up. We're always thinking about new locations, and this world of plant-based creativity. It's just like back in 2008 when we first started looking at the gaps left in a conventional sushi menu when you take off all the unsustainable stuff. It's not about saying, oh, we can only serve these few things. It's about, look at all the opportunity we have to be creative. And this is just that again, but it's in a new space.
Well, I'm certainly going to wish you luck. It's such a noble project and such a smart project. And in some ways, I think the way of the future. You know, I've always been supportive of it. So I'm glad we had the opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us
on. Thank
you. And for all your support over the years. Yeah, I don't know. I can't predict the future, but I do think that the world is changing, and the more that we can get ahead of it, the better, you know, for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah,
Makes perfect sense.
All right. Take care, guys. Thanks again.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right. Bye.
Thank you to Cassin and Kin for joining me. This was an episode that I'd wanted to do for a while, and I think it paid off. I hope you do, too. You can follow Shizen on Instagram and Facebook at ShizenSF, ShizenSF. Follow Cassin on Twitter at Cassin Trenor, CassonTrenor. Follow me at Bittman or at Mark Bittman on Instagram. Please follow the podcast. Follow everything. Follow the Bittman Project. That's bittmanproject.com. And thank you for joining us. Join us again next week when we will have somebody awesome. All right. Take care in the meantime.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.